Last in the procession came Jali Hora, wearing not the crown with the blue stone, but another, even more splendid creation. The Epiphany crown, a mass of gleaming metal and flashing faux jewels, which seemed too heavy for his ancient scrawny neck to support. Two deteras held his elbows and guided his uncertain footsteps onto the stairway that led down to the Nile. As the procession descended, so those worshippers nearest to the head of the stairs rose to their feet, lit their torches at the brazier, and followed the abbot down. There was a general movement along the terrace to join the flow, and as it began to empty, Nicholas lifted Royan from her perch on the balustrade. "We must get into the church while there are still enough people around to cover us," he whispered. Leading her by the hand, with his other hand hanging onto the strap of his camera bag, he joined the movement down the terrace. He allowed them to be carried forward, but all the time he was edging across the stream of humanity towards the entrance to the church. He saw Boris and Tessé in the crush ahead of him, but they had not seen him, and he crouched lower, so as to screen himself from them. As he and Royan reached the gateway to the outer chamber of the church, he eased them out of the throng of humanity and drew her gently through the low entrance into the dim, deserted interior. With a quick glance, he made certain that they were alone, and that the guards were no longer at their stations beside the inner gates. Then he moved quickly along the side wall to where one of the soot-grimed tapestries hung from the ceiling to the stone floor. He lifted the folds of heavy woven wool and drew Royan behind them, letting them fall back into place, concealing them both. They were only just in time, for hardly had they flattened their backs against the wall and let the tapestry settle when they heard footsteps approaching from the Kiddist. Nicholas peeked around the corner of the tapestry and saw four white-robed priests cross the outer chamber and swing the main doors closed as they left the church. There was a weighty thud from outside as they dropped the locking beam into place, and then a profound silence pervaded the cavern. "I didn't reckon on that," Nicholas whispered. "They have locked us in for the night." "At least it means that we won't be disturbed," Royan replied briskly. "We can get to work right away." Stealthily they emerged from their hiding place and moved across the outer chamber to the doorway of the Quiddist. Here Nicholas paused and cautioned her with a hand on her arm. "From here on, we're in forbidden territory. Better let me go ahead and scout the lie of the land." She shook her head firmly. "You're not leaving me here. I'm coming with you all the way." He knew better than to argue. "Come on, then." He led her up the steps and into the middle chamber. It was smaller and lower than the room they had left. The wall hangings were richer and in better state of repair. The floor was bare, except for a pyramid-shaped framework of hand-hewn native timber, upon which stood rows of brass lamps, each with the wick floating in a puddle of melted oil. The meagre light they provided was all that there was, and it left the ceiling and the recesses of the chamber in shadow. As they crossed the floor towards the gates that closed off the Makdas, Nicholas took two electric torches from his camera bag and handed one to her. "New batteries," he told her, "but don't waste them. We may be here all night." They stopped in front of the doors to the Holy of Holies. Quickly, Nicholas examined them. There were engravings of St. Frumentius on each panel, his head enclosed in a nimbus of celestial radiance, and his right hand lifted in the act of benediction. "Primitive lock," he murmured. "Must be hundreds of years old. You could throw your hat through the gap between the hasp and the tongue." He slipped his hand into the bag and brought out a leatherman tool. "Clever little job, this. With it you do anything from digging the stones out of a horse's hoof to opening the lock on a chastity belt." He knelt in front of the massive iron lock and unfolded one of the multiple blades of the tool. She watched anxiously as he worked, and then gave a little start as, with a satisfying clunk, the tongue of the lock slid back. "Misspent youth?" she asked. "Burglary amongst your many talents." "You don't really want to know." He stood up and put his shoulder to one leaf of the door. It gave with a groan of unlubricated hinges, and he pushed it open only just wide enough for them to squeeze through, then immediately shut it behind them. They stood side by side on the threshold of the Makdas and gazed about them in silent awe. The Holy of Holies was a small chamber, much smaller than either of them had expected. Nicholas could have crossed it in a dozen strides. The vaulted roof was so low that by standing on tiptoe, he could have touched it with his outstretched fingertips. From the floor upwards, the walls were lined with shelves upon which stood the gifts and offerings of the faithful, icons of the Trinity and the Virgin rendered in Byzantine style, framed in ornate silver. There were ranks of statuettes of saints and emperors, medallions and wreaths made of polished metal, pots and bowls and jewelled boxes, candelabra with many branches, on each of which the votive candles burned, providing an uncertain wavering light. It was an extraordinary collection of junk and treasures, of objects of virtue and garish bric-a-brac, offered as articles of faith by the emperors and chieftains of Ethiopia over the centuries. In the centre of the floor stood the altar of cedar wood, the panels carved with visionary scenes of revelation and creation, of the temptation and the fall from Eden, and of the Last Judgment. The altar cloth was crocheted raw silk, and the cross and the chalice were in massive worked silver. The abbot's crown gleamed in the candlelight, with the blue ceramic seal of Taita in the centre of its brow. Rayanne crossed the floor and knelt in front of the altar. She bowed her head in prayer. Nicholas waited respectfully at the threshold until she rose to her feet again, and then he went to join her. "The Tabard Stone," he pointed beyond the altar, and they went forward side by side. At the back of the Makdas stood an object covered with a heavy damask cloth, encrusted with embroidered thread of silver and gold. From the outline beneath the covering they could see that it was of elegant and pleasing proportions, as tall as a man, but slender, with a pedestal topping. They both circled it, studying the cloak shape avidly, but reluctant to touch it or to uncover it, fearful that their expectations might prove unwarranted, and that their hopes would be dashed like the turbulent river waters plunging into the cauldron of the Nile. Nicholas broke the tension and gripped them by turning away from the Tabard Stone to the barred gate in the back wall of the sanctuary. "The tomb of St. Frumentius," he said, and went to the grill. She came to his side, and together they peered through the square openings in the woodwork that was black with age. The interior was in darkness. Nicholas prodded his torch through one of the openings and pressed the switch. The tomb lit up in a rainbow of colour, so bright in the beam of the torch that their eyes took a few moments to adjust, and then Royan gasped aloud, "Oh, sweet heaven!" She began to tremble as if in high fever, and her face went creamy pale as all the blood drained from it. The coffin was set into a stone shelf in the rear wall of the cell-like tomb. On the exterior was painted the likeness of the man within. Although it was badly faded, and most of the paint had flaked away, the pale face and reddish beard of the dead man was still discernible. Though this was not the only reason for Ryan's amazement, she was staring at the walls above and on either side of the shelf on which the coffin lay. They were a riot of colour, every inch of them covered with the most intricate and elaborate paintings that had miraculously weathered the passage of the millennia. Nicholas played his torch beam over them in awe-struck silence, and Ryan clung to his arm as if to save herself from falling. She dug her sharp nails into his flesh, but he was heedless of the pain. There were scenes of great battles, fighting galleys locked in terrible combat upon the blue eternal waters of the river. There were scenes of the hunt, the pursuit of the river horse and of great elephants with long tusks of gleaming ivory. There were battle scenes of regiments plumed and armoured, raging in their fury and bloodlust. Squadrons of chariots wheeled and charged each other across these narrow walls, half obscured by the dust of their own mad career. The foreground of each mural was dominated by the same tall, heroic figure. In one scene he drew the bow to full stretch. In another he swung high the blade of bronze. His enemies quailed before him. He trod them underfoot or gathered together their severed heads like a bouquet of flowers. Nicholas played the beam over all this splendid array of art, and brought it to a stop upon the central panel that covered the entire main wall above the shelf on which the rotting coffin lay. Here the same godlike figure rode the footplate of his chariot. In one hand he held the bow, and in the other a bundle of javelins. His head was bare of any helmet, and his hair flowed out behind him in the wind of his passage, a thick golden braid like the tail of a lion. His features were noble and proud, his gaze direct and indomitable. Below him was a legend in classical Egyptian hieroglyphics. In a sepulchral whisper, Rohan translated them aloud. "Great Lion of Egypt, best of 100,000, holder of the gold of valour, Pharaoh's sole companion, warrior of all the gods, may you live for ever." Her hand shook upon his arm, and her voice choked and died away, stifled with emotion. She gave a little sob and then shook herself as she brought herself back under control. "I know this artist," she said softly. "I have spent 5 years studying his work. I would know it anywhere." She drew a breath. "I know with utter certainty that nearly 4,000 years ago, Taita the slave decorated these walls and designed this tomb." She pointed to the name of the dead man carved into the stone above the shelf on which his coffin lay. "This is not the tomb of a Christian saint. Centuries ago, some old priest must have stumbled upon it, and in his ignorance usurped it for his own religion." She drew another shaky breath. "Look there. That is the seal of Tanus, Lord Hareb, the commander of all the armies of Egypt, lover of Queen Lostris, and the natural father of Prince Memnon, who became the Pharaoh Tammuz." They were both silent then, lost in the wonder of their discovery. Nicholas broke the silence at last. "It's all true, then. The secrets of the seventh scroll are all here for us, if we can find the key to them." "Yes," she said softly. "The key. Taita's stone testament." She turned back towards the tablet stone and approached it slowly, almost fearfully. "I can't bring myself to look, Nicky. I'm terrified that it's not what we hope it is. You do it." He went directly to the column, and with a magician's flourish jerked away the damask cloth that covered it. They stared at the pillar of pink mottled granite that he had revealed. It was about 6 feet high and a foot square at the base, tapering up to half that width at the flat pedestal of the summit. The granite had been polished and then engraved. Rohan stepped forward and touched the cold stone, running her fingers lingeringly over the hieroglyphic script in the way a blind man reads Braille. "Taita's letter to us," she whispered, picking out the symbol of the hawk with a broken wing from the mass of close-chiselled script, tracing the outline with a long, slim forefinger that trembled softly. "Written almost 4,000 years ago. Waiting all these ages for us to read and understand it. See how he has signed it." Slowly she circled the granite pillar, studying each of the four sides in turn, smiling and nodding, frowning and shaking her head, and then smiling again, as if it were a love letter. "Read it to me," Nicholas invited. "It's too complicated for me. I understand the characters, but I cannot follow the sense or the meaning. Explain it to me." "It's pure Taita," she laughed, her awe and wonder at last giving way to excitement. "He is being his usual obscure and capricious self." It was as though she were talking of a beloved but infuriating old friend. "It's all in verse, and is probably some esoteric code of his own.